Morning, everybody. I'm Tim Burkett, the guiding teacher at Zen Center. I'd like to introduce our guest speaker for today, Eric Storley. Eric Storley is one of the founders of Minnesota Zen Center. He is the author of a book called Nothing on My Mind about his early years as a Zen student and a roustabout. That's what he was. First he was a roustabout, and then he became a Zen student. Is that accurate?
Yeah, roustabout, then psychedelic Zen warrior, then Zen student. So this was Berkeley, you know, in the 60s.
And he currently lives a few blocks from here, as he has for many years. With his wife Tamara, he teaches Zen meditation at the Center for Spirituality at the University of Minnesota, and he has been a friend of Zen Center's and mine for many years. And we're very happy to have him here today.
Well, thank you, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here. Hello, everybody. Good to see you. How are the roads? Yeah. It's too bad. That's, Minnesota has been my home except for 4 years in the Bay Area, and I really miss the old Minnesota winters. And one benefit is there was never ice first, because now we get this 32-degree snow. It melts right on the surfaces, and then it can freeze, and then we may get some more snow. So this is called transiency in Buddhism. Things change. Things change all the time, and global warming is one of those changes that I don't accept. And that's tough. I don't like it, but no one asked my permission, so we have it. But it's wonderful to have a day like this. 2 years ago, when we did Rohatsu, we had a heavy winter storm right away, and that felt great. So I just sat the 7 days of the retreat here, the Rohatsu Sesshin, and my restless mind kept thinking, well, the weather isn't good enough. I want snow. I want it to be 30 below. And then I remembered a session in Dinkytown before the Zen Center bought this house where it was 30 below and lots of snow. And my battery on my car froze. And I had to call my father. This was early 70s, so I was in my early 30s, and he was furious. Eric, you know enough to start the car a few times, don't you? You grew up in Minnesota. Of course, the subtext was, what the hell are you doing 7 days sitting at some Zen center when you could be finishing your doctorate and getting a life? So I remember that fondly, and I remember fondly that he had to come over and help me start the car, which he did. That's Minnesota. You do those things, of course. Well, fortunately, I found some books in the library downstairs, but I waited till the last day of the session, and of course, Rosemary made trouble for me by asking me to do this talk, and then I had 7 days knowing that I'd come out of the session and have to show up and say something. So it would come up and up and up and up, and that's all right. As I said to Rosemary and Tim, if I hadn't had that object, there would have been some other object. That's the nature of our consciousness. But the beauty of a long sitting like the Rohatsu is that very slowly the things can settle and one can have a kind of open state just of awareness. Sometimes it can be blissful, sometimes just even, but very big. And then the mind says, oh, I like this. And then, of course, you've already interrupted it. So there's a wonderful book that I've read in called Flow. And we're really talking about flow states. And I can't pronounce his name. Mihail, I thought I'd made a note, so Cheek sent me high. and he points out that the human goal is basically happiness. However, you can't directly become happy. You can't come here and sit zazen and have a mantra, I am getting happier and happier and happier. So we can do things like metta practice, may all beings be healthy, may I be healthy, and that can have an impact. But ultimately, the mind is working with an object, with a project. So a mantra is a project. When I first started practicing, Suzuki Roshi simply said, well, count your breaths. So I'd count my breaths. Boring. And then I'd stop that and just follow my breath. Well, then my mind would wander. And now I still tell my students at the university, just count your breath. When the mind settles enough, follow the breath. When the mind settles enough, just be there, aware. No assignment. So we could call it the meditation or the zazen of no assignment. Because as soon as you give yourself an assignment, you have a divided mind. I am following my breath. So in a sense, the beauty of just counting breaths is it is so boring. It's unattractive in the sense that we're not saying anything positive to ourselves or saying a sacred magic Sanskrit word that may be infusing my being. We're just being here. Utterly simple. And that's the most difficult. But the good news is it develops. It's a flow state. And a beautiful just being. But this morning, so I'd had various thoughts. I've spent my life as a student of literature, of religion, philosophy. I love to think. I love to analyze. I love to get three versions of a koan and look at them all and think, well, what does this tell me? And which version really is most accurate? And what version might capture something from some ancient Chinese exchange that was then written down? First, it was probably remembered and retold. So Rosemary said she hears stories about Katagiri Roshi, and it's like telephone, right? Oh, yeah, so-and-so remembered and told me that she said that he said. Well, no, someone else says, well, no, that wasn't. So we know that's exactly what happened back in the Tang Dynasty. And yet then we have versions. So we can look at that. But this morning, then, I got up at 6, not 5, thank God, which I did for the previous 7 days, and just looked at a very simple story and became beautifully absorbed in a flow state of study, analysis, looking, appreciation. But during that flow state, I was not aware of my big toes. I was not aware of my stomach. I might get a flash of, this foot is cold, I'll stick my slipper on again. But because I had a project, in this case, reading, analyzing, thinking, taking notes, that was my object. That was my flow state. In the Sesshin, however, as we cultivate no project, essentially, the flow state, you could say, simply becomes the flow of the flow, just being here. And in that state, I know my toes are there. I'm present in my body. My body is doing zazen. My breath is doing zazen. My mind is doing zazen. But even saying doing zazen is extra. It's just, here. Here, I remember Suzuki at a sesshin in the 60s, after all of us hippie Americans had squirmed and struggled through, and a few tough guys like Dan Welsh just sat without moving, and he lifted up his stick and said, "Well, someday your mind can be even." Oh, I wonder when that'll be. But he always seemed very even, except I did see occasional embarrassment, anger, frustration. Tim knows far more about that than I, because he had the good fortune of spending a lot of one-on-one time bringing Suzuki down to Stanford and working with him. So you'll have to ask him about times that he saw Suzuki's level stick tilt. So I think it's very helpful to think about flow states, especially when I'm talking to students at the university who come into this. We've created over the last 10 years some academic courses, credit bearing, a couple of graduate courses, an undergrad course. And this was really my goal very early on. I never became a Buddhist, never became a priest. To me, that was very much in the way, because it would have separated me or isolated me in some sense from my parents, who were intellectual, free-thinking, wilderness and art-loving, left-wing people. And religion was bunk, the opiate of the masses. So my mother particularly was very annoyed that I was engaged with Zen, although they both realized my drug abuse had greatly diminished, so there was kind of an acceptance at the same time. And they met the categories and liked them, and so, okay, this looks all right. But one of my professors said, "Well, I'm very disturbed by the anti-intellectualism of Zen." And there is that element, and that's an Achilles heel. So it can, as in many Zen centers, get very stupid, where people don't know they're being conned by some great master who has a very good act. Edo Roshi seems to be a prime example now. It's 50 years of bad acting are surfacing publicly. They were there, and they were known and hidden, but now they're, because of the web, they're out there. But so we generally love flow states. I have some musicians in my classes this semester, and I always ask students to describe flow states they've had. And one fellow said, oh, there was a, I worked on a choral piece or a singing piece with another singer. We both loved the music. I forget what it was. And we worked endlessly preparing for a performance. And when we performed, I was there, but I wasn't there. It was just, perfect. And then he said something interesting. He said, and everyone agreed who was in the audience or the people who I talked to afterwards, but I never went back and listened to that thing that was recorded. Never listened. So that wasn't necessary at that point. The full experience was complete in that period of time and done. And then he could move on. So in that sense, his mind didn't go back to say, well, now, let me re-enjoy. No, let's move on. Next thing. And all of us have had flow states as children. So a day like this, I would go out over near Cedar Lake where I grew up, and as a kid, maybe just get on snow pants and sit outside, make a snowman, look at snow falling. Utterly peaceful. And then, of course, the door opens. It's time for lunch. Oh, hell. But, so we know those flow states. And yet we have to put in, as a child, we don't have to put in effort to have that flow state. As an adult, as we get all of this complicated prefrontal cortex coming online, it gets much more complicated. Then we have to make effort. And yet the goal, or the non-goal of the effort, is effortlessness, effortless flow. So how many of you have had a childhood flow state? For how many was it outside somewhere, in open nature? Yeah, very common. And the hard question, how many of you know that place is now developed in some way? Yeah, we're losing those places. Pull up a chair. Is that Lee? You're in shadow. Well, bring a chair. Yeah. Not at all. Not at all. But I've just been talking about flow states. But there's a negative side. There's a wonderful, compelling, awful book by Carl Marlantes about Vietnam, where he served. And he says, combat veterans don't share this much, but I have never had an experience as high and compelling as combat. Firefight, never. Nothing touches it. Sex, drugs, rock and roll. I don't know if he's tried sesheen. But work is being done now to bring mindfulness into work with combat, with PTSD. Well, All of that said, let me tell you what my busy little mind was thinking about and moving into its own little intellectual flow state. So I was looking at the Gateless Gate, and there's a koan story, teaching story, number 18, called Tozan's 3 pounds. Tozan's 3 pounds. And I've got Reps and Senzaki's translation, R.H. Blythe, and Kuan Yamada. So very interesting just to look at this. And I started by thinking about what can we know about this? So Tozan, a famous Zen master, his dates, presumably, are 910 to 990. Very interesting. At that time, the Anglo-Saxons were running around conquering England. But we're talking about a culture that already had encyclopedias, history, a very high culture. Mumon, who gathered these stories in a little compilation called The Gateless Gate, was born 1183. So he's already looking at things that happened 300 years ago. And both Blythe and Yamada speculate that Mumon got the stories from the Hikigen Roku and the Gutoegen, which I've never looked at. So we have now frozen in Mumon's Chinese of the 1180s or, say, the 1200s, the words that presumably were told and retold a few times by someone 300 years earlier, and then presumably written down somewhere at that time in some record, and I didn't see any talk about that here, in the Chinese of about 1000. Now, I went to Berkeley to become a medievalist. Chaucer, Gawain and the Green Knight, the Pearl Poets, the language of, oh, the late 1300s in England. So I spent a lot of time learning about how difficult it is to take language that's a few hundred years old and then put it into, first, to understand what it possibly might have meant to the speakers. Now, Chaucer, for example, was not read. Most people were illiterate, even in the court. So he spoke his poems as performances, but he also wrote them down. So we have his, generally his words, although all sorts of scholastic debates as you look at certain lines, as you'll see in, for instance, the Genjo Koan. If you look at Abe and Masao's translation of Dogen, you'll have a page that's about a third Dogen and two-thirds commentary trying to figure out what Dogen's Japanese might have meant, because it's also very poetic. So you not only have the issue of what was meant in 1200 when someone said this word, and is there anything analogous today by which we can speak that word? And do we even know? Is this something that, in fact, is lost? It's lost. So, in Shakespeare's time, someone might be described as having a hot liver. Translate that today. If I came in and said, well, I have a hot liver, you'd know you were hearing some kind of koan. And there was a meaningful answer, yes. So better, I would have to say, I'm pissed. Yeah, that would work. But if you went back and said that to Shakespeare, he'd say, oh, well, can I get you some towels? And so we've got huge problems as we look at this stuff. But let's look anyway, because it's fun. It's fun, and it's instructive. And the reason that we have a book like this and the fascination of the beatniks, like Kerouac and Snyder and Ginsberg, with Buddhism was primarily Zen, because the old Chinese Zen teachers had this sense of free, spontaneous, no rules, and boy, they loved that. You know, great, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and it's my religion. And then, of course, it gets far more complicated, because all of this came out of monastic settings where there are precepts. So you're not behaving randomly. You're not behaving randomly. I remember Katagiri in San Francisco said he had gotten on a bus with some hippie who had come to the Zen Center, and Katagiri said politely, oh, where are you going? And the guy said, I don't know. I don't know. And Katagiri chuckled, well, okay. But the young guy thought he was expressing his, you know, freedom and understanding. Maybe he was. Maybe he was really the next Buddha. I don't know. Of course, we're all Buddha. So, well, let's look at Tozan's flax. One of my favorite stories, and it's very short. Tozan's 3 pounds. A monk, and this is Reps and Senzaki. And incidentally, both Reps and Senzaki were in that spirit of anti-monasticism, anti-formality. My friend Loring Palmer said that Reps, who was born in 1899 or so, he came to the Page Street Zen Center to practice, and so at that point he had to be in his about 70, and people got hot livers about Reps because he didn't follow the schedule. He'd walk in and sit down in Zazen for a while, then he'd get up and wander out and up and down the street. So, oh, nice practice you have here, but what's the big deal? How come you're so full of your schedule? Very interesting guy that he early on became fascinated with Asia, went to Japan and China, and eventually compiled this book, which was one of the early texts that we liked. And Senzaki was actually similar, a Japanese monk who said, I asked my teacher to let me abandon all forms and titles and ceremonies of my religion. And I'm quoting him now, so don't be annoyed. He said, I just want to be a happy Jap walking the streets, which he did in some sense. So he created the floating Zendo, meaning wherever he went, if people would sit with him, they could sit with him. So I think this translation has that quality. But a monk asked Tozan when he was weighing some flax, what is Buddha? Tozan said, this flax weighs 3 pounds. That's the story. That's the whole story. A monk asked Tozan when he was weighing some flax, what is Buddha? Tozan said, this flax weighs 3 pounds. Then Mumon, the compiler, makes a comment. Old Tozan Zen is like a clam. The minute the shell opens, you see the hole inside. However, I want to ask you, me, do you see the real Tozan? And then a little verse of Mumon's at the end. 3 pounds of flax in front of your nose. Close enough, and mind is still closer. Whoever talks about affirmation and negation lives in the right and wrong region. End of story and commentary. So let's compare that with Blythe. And Blythe gives us far more commentary than story. A monk asked Tozan, "What is the Buddha?" He replied, 3 pounds of flax. Now, what's missing in this one that's in the other one? Yeah, what's he doing? Weighing flax. But Yamato omits that also. So Senzaki must have supplied that detail. We are here weighing flax, which changes a great deal. So Reps and Suzaki have added a detail that's apparently not in the original. And of course, another problem as we look at this is that even Yamada, a speaker of modern Japanese, might have spent years studying ancient Japanese and ancient Chinese, but they're not his native tongue. So we've got all these telephone translation problems. But Rep says, well, okay, we're going to decide that he's weighing flax. Then Blythe, for the commentary, has, old Tozan Zen is rather like a clam. When it just when it just opens the two halves of the shell, you can see the liver and the intestines. But though this may be so, just say, where can we see Tozan? So what's added here that Reps doesn't have? Anatomical details, right. Liver and intestines. And Yamada has liver and intestines as well. So I presume Reps chose to leave those out. Why? I don't know. I would have to be a student of ancient Chinese language and culture to have an idea whether the liver mentioned here has a connotation like Shakespeare's 300 years ago, 400 years ago. So I don't know. Now, Senzaki is a native Japanese speaker and presumably a student of ancient Chinese might have said, oh, well, it's obvious. It's obvious what's going on. He's there at the monastery. They're reaping the flax. They're weighing it out, and they're getting ready to bring it to town, and someone's going to sell some flax, and they'll get some whatever, some grain or whatever. But we don't know. All guesswork. So Reps and Senzaki simply translate that. Old Tozan Zen is like a clam. The minute the shell opens, you see the hole inside. Now, maybe that's what in ancient China was implied by liver and intestines. In the same way that if I said, Well, you know, when Tim did X, he was showing a lot of guts. So that could be expressing something similar. Liver and intestines might have simply said, ah, he's really showing his moxie. We don't know. But then reps also gives us, however, I want to ask you. So he makes it more of the challenge. Do you see the real Tozan? So Tozan's opened up here somehow by saying 3 pounds of flax. He's opened up the whole world of himself, the meaning of life, whether there is or is not a God, Buddha, Dharma, everything's open now. Just wake up. Good luck. So then let's look at the final comment. Oh, where's the little poem? The verse. Let's start with reps again. So the final little verse. 3 pounds of flax in front of your nose. Close enough, and mind is still closer. Well, let's try those two. 3 pounds of flax, artlessly, spontaneously, it comes out. The words and the meaning are intimate, indivisibly so. That gets very abstract. Blythe is a scholar. Suddenly we've got the words and the meaning are intimate, indivisibly so. 3 pounds of flax, artlessly, spontaneously, it comes out. Rep simply has 3 pounds of flax in front of your nose. But now, Yamada agrees with Blythe that that line is referring to something in the way that the statement was made. 3 pounds of flax, artlessly, spontaneously, comes out of Tozan's mouth. So it's about his words just jumping out effortlessly. So reps changes that. 3 pounds of flax in front of your nose. So then if we have the context of they're out there weighing flax in the field, and the young monk comes up and says, what's the Buddha? And Tozan says, here, 3 pounds of flax under your nose. Here it is. So who's right? Reps is making stuff up. And yet, to me, without that, the story loses its essence. And you see that, I think, with Yamada, who doesn't translate for us 3 pounds of flax. Rather, this is a miracle of the web. So I found this in the library, but I found it late. And so I went and I said, well, maybe I can get my own copy because I always underline. And Amazon said, if you pay $11, you can have this tomorrow. So I thought, I don't believe it. But I did it, and it came. It was there yesterday morning. There it was.
3 pounds of flax.
3 pounds, right, here it is. But the problem with the web is we don't have, I just read a thing, someone sent me a thing on web education, that's the wave of the future. All the dinosaur model of universities and bricks and mortar, as our esteemed ex-governor said, they are dinosaurs. Believe me, working over the web, you will not have Tozan putting his 3 pounds of flax under Ben's nose, you'll have a screen. And if you think about the teachers who mattered to you, they were living beings who you connected with. And that is at risk. That's all at risk. But anyway, Yamadok says Tozan's Masagan, which is clearly the Japanese for 3 pounds of flax. And he goes into that Masagin, and his take on it is that without the context of 3 pounds of actual flax, he assumes there's no context, and maybe this is happening in the Zendo or at tea. And the young man says, "Oh, what's the Buddha?" And Tozan says, 3 pounds of flax. Huh? Why? And Yamada actually goes on to explain that, oh, well, Tozan could have just said ma, or sa, or gin, and it would have been the same brilliant, meaningful, enlightening, turning word for the young man. And I'm thinking, no, this is a case of literalism where Yamada won't step beyond what the barriers are of, well, I've got to know exactly what the language is, and I won't add anything. So to me, we end up with a story where the turning word could be, what is the Buddha? Oh, Governor Pawlenty. Or just Governor. Anything. Now, at that point, you get to a kind of Zen double talk where anybody can claim anything about these stories. And there's a bizarre, to me, movement of Americans who somehow think they can test you through a series of koans and then approve you. That would worry me. On what basis, given that we can't understand these things in any accurate, deep, complete way? We can understand them in a very deep way, but it's just what we're coming up with. So we're playing telephone, back through a millennium, more than a millennium. But if we accept the context that reps supplies, then guess what? Tozan's old Zen is like a clam. The minute the shell opens, you see the whole inside. Tozan's in a flow state. Tozan is weighing flax. He's like my musician who was playing the concert, totally engaged, 100% playing that music. Tozan is 100% weighing out this beautiful material carefully. He's there. So when he's asked, what is the Buddha? It's me weighing out this flax with total and complete attention. Nothing extra, no assignment. Yes, I'm assigned to weigh out the flax, but I'm not wishing the task were over or wishing there were more flax or less flax. I'm just weighing out this flax. Ah! And then Rep says, or Tozan says, however, I want to ask you, do you see the real Tozan? That is, are we there? Can we see ourselves in that utter completion? So I love this story because it is susceptible, I think, to the intellectual analysis. And yet it tells us something very important and simple about just what happens when effort moves into the effortness of a flow state, when effort moves into the effortlessness of a flow state. And in some sense, the ultimate flow state is that openness of just, I'm here with my fingers, my toes, my breath, my consciousness. Maybe a thought tickles, but I don't have to do anything other than just there. It's okay. So, to me, that's what the story means. And if we simply put in something like, in Hyakujo's fox, I won't go into it, but at some point, Hyakujo says to his student, they're about to exchange slaps, and Hyakujo says, oh, I thought a barbarian had a red beard, now I know he has a red beard. Well, that means nothing to us, and I'm not sure what it might have meant in ancient China, but it might have been like, I'm pissed, or you're cool. It might have been, you're cool. You got a red beard. You're cool. Calling the student a barbarian, of course, is an insult, but it may have been like, I can have breakfast with Tim and say, you jerk, why did you? Yeah, so we just don't know. But you get a sense of Yamada's literalism in that story, because he, in his commentary, he says, now, very important that actually the student didn't slap Hyakujo. No. That would have been very disrespectful. And my master, Yasutani, told me not to think that an actual slap was delivered, but only a feint. And his master told him that that was the way it was too. So don't think you can slap your master. Well, that defeats the whole thing that attracted me and a whole bunch of beatniks to Zen in the first place. That sense of we're opening the clam, we're breaking out of this mold of rigid, hierarchical, religious formality. That was, read Kerouac, Dharma Bums. And of course, they were screwy too. They went way in the direction of, oh, well, now everything's freedom, everything's spontaneity. So reps would annoy people at the San Francisco Zen Center by not obeying the rules. Or when Philip Whalen, one of the beat poets, came there in the 71, 72, and later became the abbot of the Castro Street Zendo. I remember at the first sesshin Philip did, I guess he'd never done this before. He'd lived in Japan for years. But by the second day or so, he went kind of berserk. And he was a big, large man with a huge, bushy beard. And I was down in the basement where that big drum is. And a couple of other people there. And Philip just ran up and grabbed the stick for the drum and just started hammering on the drum in the middle of God knows what in the sesshin. And one of the other hefty young men ran over and pinned his arms. Oh my God, how can you do that? You're ruining everything. So that was the beatnik response to the Zen schedule, the strict monastic schedule. But then Philip got with the program and became a priest and a Dharma heir, in part because Dick Baker was so good at collecting artsy people and important and impressive people, and Philip was one of the players back in the early days in North Beach. So what else could I say about this? Whoever talks about affirmation and negation lives in the right and wrong region. Well, you know, if Tozan is asked, what is the Buddha? And then he says, well, the Buddha is this and this and this and this. That already excludes that and that. And it is this, but not that. So Tozan's answer is not theoretical at all. Just, ah, here we are. Ah, here we are. Beautiful flax. Beautiful weighing. Ah. So, any questions, comments? Thank you for listening, but say something.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Listening to this, I was struck by something that I hadn't realized before. I don't know enough of the koans to say this with any certainty, but it seems to me that many, many of them are actually stories about interactions between two people, two beings.
Yeah.
And they're really, I think, it's not so much, maybe these stories aren't so much vehicles to convey the deep enlightenment of the teacher as they are to portray a spontaneous interaction between two people who are present in the moment and sharing that.
Yeah. 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 I mean, again, I don't think we can know exactly because of the telephone factor that they're told and retold.
Right.
They captured the imagination at the time. They got written down. And then you've got the whole textual thing of text being copied and recopied and recopied. So, but they're above all interactions between two people.
And this sort of spontaneous interaction between two people who are not attached to goals, but are just part of what is, that's a good thing. That's the thing that draws me to Zen, mm-hmm. because that's what I want in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you got stories like Nansen cuts the cat in two, and he's criticized implicitly by, I forget who he's talking to, Joshu. He's broken the precepts. Yeah, he's killed a living thing just to express his Zen understanding. And he's pissed at the monks who are all passive. So an immediate, dead cat. So I think it's Joshu says, or Mumon says of that one, if Joshu had been there at the time of the cutting of the cat, he would have snatched the sword and prevented the killing. So it's not like these are stories where, you know, everyone's necessarily doing what you're supposed to do or really fully open like a clam. Maybe if you're fully open like a clam, you spare the cat. You had a question.
It's not an important question, but I was kind of curious in if it is impossible with so many old texts to really understand what they might have meant to the people at the time they spoke it and at the time that spoken word was written down by someone else. If we realize that, then why do we try?
Because there are several reasons, and it's a great question. Great question. They're like myths. They've survived because they capture something so deep and essential that we resonate to them. I think of Jesus's parable of the vineyard, for example, where the owner of the vineyard needs to bring in the crop, and he stands at the gate and says, "Hey, I need workers. Dollar a day, well, 100 a day." And then toward the end of the day, someone comes and says, "I'll work, yep, 100 a day." And then the people who came earlier are angry. "Well, how come you gave that guy $100? He only worked an hour." So we can think and talk about a story like that in the Christian context, and it's both provocative, wonderful, beautiful, and it's there. It was remembered because it caught something.
Can I ask you a follow-up?
Yeah, sure.
Do you think it's just a human nature of wanting discourse, and the attempt to then maybe try to disprove each other in there? If it's a myth, then we acknowledge that there can't really be a fundamental truth. The truth becomes a personal yet shared truth, but it always will have a different shade, different facet to everybody. Yet if we try to analyze it, then we assume that it can be analyzed, which I thought it can.
Yeah.
So is that just an invitation to live our human nature, to fight with each other and argue, because that's what we like to do?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but we do that. So, well, I mean, there's a lot there. Is there a fundamental nature? Is there a Buddha Dharma? Is there a God? Is there a Allah? Tozan would say, this flax weighs 3 pounds. I'm here. That's all I know. That's all I know, in a sense. I remember Suzuki was asked at one time about reincarnation. And he said, I will be scolded for saying this, but I have no experience of reincarnation. Now, the Soto Zen order would say, teach reincarnation. Suzuki, because he was, I think, very transparent, just said, but is there a fundamental nature? Time, space, matter, energy? They're all there. And we can add, from Eastern and religious thought, consciousness. So we have all of these things are there, and we participate in them. And we get to debate and argue and fight. And it trips us up a lot. Trips us up a lot. Yeah.
Time.
Time,
yeah.
Okay. Sure. Well, as Click and Clack say, you've wasted a perfectly good hour here when you could have been outside making snowmen. And Ted, what was that? Samadhi of frolic
and play.
Yeah. Ted recommended in the session the samadhi of frolic and play. One final sentence. Flow, this 3 pounds of flax, playing this beautiful concert, that is play. So we look very tough here in the 7 days of sitting. But if it's really happening, it's play. It's really, it's just, 3 pounds of flax under my nose. So thank you very much.
Thank you.